Raised Sports is a proud member of the Storyhanger Podcast Network. For more information, go to storyhanger.com. Before we start this episode, I would like to mention our special friends at Cool Fire Studios, a wonderful graphic design, printing, and art studio. Whether you need a t-shirt, business cards, posters, anything to make a splash, Cool Fire Studios artists will create something unique and amazing to help you stand out. How do I know this? Because Cool Fire has worked on the Raised Sports t-shirts, and they should be arriving soon. I'm really excited. They're going to look awesome. So watch for those coming soon. And in the meantime, check out Cool Fire Studios. That's cool with a K. CoolFireStudios.com. Now on with the show.
What needs to change as a society, I think, is we don't need to put tackle football up on a pedestal. It's just a game, and it causes brain damage, and people are still cheering this on. I don't understand it. I see it plain as day. No, and it's too late for my son.
For decades now, football has been America's favorite sport. We love its athleticism, its speed, its grace, and if we're being honest, we also love its violence and its brutality.
He hasn't moved since he took that hit.
The players are modern-day gladiators, sacrificing their bodies for every yard of Coliseum turf.
Once again, a violent collision. This one's head-to-head.
They get dinged up, they get their bells rung, and then they shake it off and get back out there, all for our entertainment.
Are you not entertained?
But it is becoming increasingly apparent that there is a price to be paid for this entertainment. Long-term effects that can dramatically impact the lives of both the athletes and their loved ones.
People need to know that the human brain is a post-mitotic organ. It doesn't have any reasonable capacity to cure itself of injuries.
Welcome to Season 1 of the Raised Sports Podcast, in which we'll tackle the issue of concussions and CTE, brain trauma in the sport of football.
He took a vicious hit. He's still down, hasn't moved.
What does it all mean for the health of the athletes, these modern-day gladiators?
I don't know how you take this out of the game of football. I don't know if there's anything you can do.
And how will our growing knowledge of the issue impact the future of the sport itself? In the long run, is it all worth it?
Atwater just killed Randy Hilliard.
Episode 4, It's Too Late for My Son. It was all over the news in January. Tyler Helinski, a bright and well-liked student at Washington State University, who is also likely to become the Cougars' starting quarterback in the fall, had committed suicide. Across the country on a farm in Wisconsin, Debbie Picka saw the story. She had assigned herself the unpleasant task of scanning the news for these kind of items, athletes in contact sports who died young. It could be anything, really. It could be homicide, suicide, overdose, even an accident. And she would immediately reach out to the victim's family. In cases like this, time is of the essence.
You don't know how they're going to react. You have to call them right away. And they're not in any kind of shape to, I guess, sometimes, especially if it's the mother, it's really hard to get through to the families because they're grieving. And, you know, it's so recently and just hours away. Those are kind of hard phone calls to make.
But Debbie didn't hesitate. She called the Washington Medical Examiner and explained her mission. The next day, with the blessing of the family and in coordination with the Mayo Clinic, it was arranged for Tyler Helinski's brain to be donated for medical research. It's a difficult thing to do, making phone calls like that, but there's a reason Debbie has taken it on. For her, it's personal.
I think I connect with them because I've been there. You know, I've lost a son. I know what it's like to lose a son. And I think that they're glad that they can talk to someone and relate to me because we both have something in common.
It was 6 years ago that Debbie Picka would find herself in the same tragic position as the Helinski family. It was June 6th, 2012. Debbie couldn't find her son, Joseph, and she was in a panic. Joseph had been prone to mood swings as he entered his 20s. He'd have these bouts of rage, storm out of the house, and just go walking. He might head a few miles down the road to his cousin's house, or just wander for a while to blow off steam. Always, though, he'd eventually call his mom or one of his two brothers or a friend just to talk. He'd calm down and he'd come home. But that night he didn't call. No one had heard from him. After an hour or two, Debbie called Joseph's cell phone. No answer. She didn't hear from him that night. The next morning, Debbie considered filing a missing persons report. She called family members. She called Joseph's work. Nobody had seen him. Debbie and her daughter, Nicole, went driving around the area, searching for him. She felt a growing sense of dread, a mother's intuition, perhaps. In her heart, she knew something terrible had happened.
I thought I was going to find him hanging in the trees on our property somewhere along our driveway. We drove around the countryside looking for him, and I was just looking in the trees thinking, am I going to find him hanging in the tree? And I drove, you know, to his cousin's. I drove around the country because he was only a few miles down the road. I couldn't find him, and I came back, and I said, I don't know what to do.
It was about that time that Debbie's husband, Joseph's stepfather, came home. He went to the shed to get something and immediately came rushing out, ordering Debbie to call 911. He didn't say why, but Debbie was terrified because in that moment she realized the shed was the one place on the farm she had not searched the night before.
I ran down the stairs. My husband tried to hold me back and I ran down the stairs, but he didn't say anything that he was dead. You know, he didn't tell me that. And I ran right straight from the shed. I don't know why. And I got to the door and there, my son is in a sitting position on the floor and he's dead. He's got a rope around his neck. And he had been dead from the night before.
Joseph was about a month shy of his 26th birthday. Joseph Chernak was like a lot of kids growing up in rural Michigan. He loved comedy movies and he could recite lines on cue. He was an honor student and involved in drama. And he and his two brothers, Tyler, a couple of years older, and Seth, just a year younger, played just about any sport you could imagine, from golf to baseball, basketball to wrestling, and of course, football. Joseph was about 11 when Debbie and his father, Jeffrey Chernak, divorced. And the boys initially moved with Debbie from their home on Michigan's Upper Peninsula back to Wisconsin. But when Debbie moved them back to her family farm so she could care for her terminally ill father, the boys found they weren't quite comfortable at the school there. Eventually, all three would go back to Michigan, to a town of about 1,500 named Crystal Falls, to live with their father. There, Joseph and his brothers would play on the Forest Park High School football team, helping the Trojans to multiple state tournament berths.
They were all really good at sports. Joseph was a senior athlete, MVP of wrestling and football. He has so many medals on it, they wouldn't all fit on his letter jacket. They have them in a glass case. It's really heavy.
Joseph was a running back on offense, elusive, a scat back. But on defense, he was a ferocious linebacker who loved to hit.
He was more of a slasher on offense, but on defense, played in the middle of the field there. He'd get dirty. He kind of played with a little bit of a disregard as far as just sacrificing his body, probably more so than I did.
That's the voice of Tyler Chernak, Joseph's older brother.
He was a tough son of a bitch. He wasn't big. He was, 5'9", 150 pounds, but he liked to hit people. I think if you asked the guys that played with him, they would probably tell you he was the best player on the field most of the time.
Even though she wasn't with her boys, Debbie had no reason to worry about them. They were all together looking after each other, and the boys, especially Joseph, were very close with their high school football coach, a man named Bill Santilli. Santilli was a Forest Park legend himself who also happened to work with the boy's father, Jeffrey, at the Michigan Department of Transportation. He was like a second father to Joseph, Debbie says, and he really made it a point to take care of his players. In retrospect, Debbie says, she thinks it was Joseph's participation in youth football that was the larger problem.
Now that I look back on it and I heard some of the stories, I felt like he was more safe in playing high school than he was even in the youth football league, because I found out later that the coach that they had were actually teaching my kids the nutcracker drill, and I never knew that, you know, until just late last couple years. And of course they played, you know, a lot of football, and that's where I think most of the damage came from, was his youth when his brain was developing. Of course, none of us knew this then.
Tyler agrees with his mom, and he remembers the nutcracker drill in particular. Now, there are different variations of this drill out there. Sometimes it's called the nutcracker, sometimes the Oklahoma drill. Sometimes it's a one-on-one thing, and sometimes there are multiple players on each side. But no matter what you want to call it, all of the versions basically boil down to one thing. It's kind of a manhood test. Two players doing everything they can to, well, I'll let Tyler explain.
The kids are laying on their backs, head facing each other. They're about spread about 10 yards apart, and a coach will blow a whistle, and they have to run full speed at each other. That's one of the drills we would do in youth football. Used to call it the nutcracker drill, but you'll see, you can look up videos, you know, basically trying to knock the shit out of each other, basically. As far as comparing that to youth football practice to high school, we never did drills in high school like that, to where one of the main, not objectives, but results would be hurting somebody. Our high school coach was pretty good about that. I mean, as far as doing crazy drills in high school and stuff, I would never say that we did anything like that. We did the normal stuff, just, you know, scrimmages, hitting a sled, offense, defense, second team, first team, nothing crazy in high school. But that one drill we did in youth football, I will remember that one.
Hindsight is a torturous thing. Anyone can look back on moments from their past and wonder what could have been if they had just noticed this or acted on that. Sometimes it's just not so obvious. With Tyler Helinski, for instance, family members, teammates, even his college coach Mike Leach, all of them said that they didn't see any signs that he was dealing with depression. But with Joseph Chernak, it was a different story. After graduating from Forest Park, his football career behind him, Joseph enrolled in Central Michigan University with an eye on becoming a physical therapist. But signs of trouble started popping up almost immediately. Joseph's personality and behavior were changing.
I know he was having symptoms right after graduation, because I've talked to some of his friends and they kind of told me some of the things that was going on with him, and, you know, the partying and the drinking and just some things that he would say that were out of character for him.
Once a good student, Joseph's grades tanked. Once a people person, Joseph became a hermit. He stopped going to class, and he eventually left college. He bounced around, back to Crystal Springs, down to Wisconsin, sometimes living with his dad, sometimes with his mom, sometimes with friends. And the situation worsened over time. At one point, Joseph told Debbie, "Look at me. I'm hopeless. There's nothing for me." At one point, he told a cousin he didn't know how much longer he could go on, and he mentioned shooting himself in the head. Debbie and Jeffrey both called the police at different times over fears that Joseph would hurt himself.
His own dad even went to the sheriff's department and told the sheriff that he was afraid he was going to find his son hanging one day. That's what he said to the sheriff. His dad didn't find him hanging, I did.
When looking back at the last 2 years of Joseph's life, Debbie describes it as a time of living in fear. She says it was like following a toddler around, keeping tabs on him, making sure he was safe and okay. His depression worsened and took hold. She made doctor's appointments for him, but that only made him angry, and he refused to go. She felt helpless and didn't know what to do for him. She felt that maybe if he had a job, he would start feeling better about himself. But he did get a job, and that didn't help either. There were two moments that, looking back, really stand out to Debbie as turning points, where she kind of realized that she might not be able to save her son. In one of them, she looked Joseph in the eye and told him bluntly, "You're not going to die before me." Joseph's response was to not respond at all. He simply looked with a blank stare and never said a word. The other moment came in May of 2012. Joseph was sitting on the couch watching breaking news coverage on television. The story was about legendary NFL linebacker Junior Seau, who had committed suicide, shocking the sports world.
And I asked him, "What is going on with all these NFL players dying?" And he didn't answer me. He just kept watching the TV. He was watching that, and then a month later, my son's dead.
It was Tyler who suggested Debbie send Joseph's brain in for testing. When she asked why, he asked if she had seen all the recent stories about NFL players dying, including Seau. She said that she had. "Well," Tyler said, "they have a brain disease." After that, Debbie researched. She read up on all the symptoms players had struggled with. The more she read, the more convinced she was that Joseph had brain damage and CTE, even though he had never been diagnosed with a sports-related concussion. It turned out that she was right. 6 years later, the guilt still gnaws at Debbie. She feels she should have protected her children better and asks herself why she didn't read up on the topic sooner. Why didn't she research? Why didn't anybody explain the risks to her? Why wasn't she warned?
Should have never let him play. Never let any of them play. Joseph, from the very first impact he had, he never had a chance. His fate was sealed. And that's the truth. We just didn't realize it. Hard for me to swallow. My kid started with these impact sports at the age of 11, and it was going to kill him down the road, and we had no clue.
For those left behind, there's always guilt, always questions about what could have been done differently. It just comes with the territory. And you don't really move on from something like this. You just realize those feelings and those questions are going to be part of your life from now on.
It's kind of one of those things that you just, you live with, you know? Yeah. You always have questions. You always wonder why. You always have regrets. Well, things he could have did and didn't do. It's gotten a little bit easier, but it's not easy at all. Especially just Joseph being the type of person he was. He had a lot of friends, and one of those guys you would never hear anybody talk bad about. Never had a drug problem. He just turned into a different person. And we all tried to get him to seek help, and he just had his own stubborn ways, and I don't know, it doesn't really ever get easier. Not for me, anyway.
Debbie keeps close tabs on Tyler and Seth, hoping that they're okay, worrying that they're not. She finds it difficult to distinguish between depression potentially related to their football careers and simply sadness in dealing with their brother's death. It's impossible for her to tell the difference. Tyler understands, but he says his knowledge does give him a big advantage.
I've suffered depression, but I mean, I could relate that to a lot of things, but nothing even close to as far as suicide or anything like that. No. When you have an issue, one of the main things that gets a lot of people through is knowing that they're not the only one.
And so Debbie waits and watches, meanwhile always keeping an eye on the news, making calls when she needs to, asking for brain donations to further advance research, spreading the word. And she urges parents to guide their kids towards sports other than football. The risks, in her mind, are just not worth it.
As a parent, you don't want to be a caregiver to your child. It's the most miserable feeling, knowing that you're going to lose your kid and you have to try to take care of them when the children should be taking care of their parents. But now this is all turning around. Care about someone young who shouldn't be in a condition like this. This is not normal, and I just wish parents would listen and quit denying the science and, you know, quit telling football is safer than ever. Football is not safe, and it never has been. They've got to realize, but they won't. I don't think they're going to realize until their child gets hurt or their child is dead. That's what it takes for some of them, especially those who are, you know, denying the science. They believed it's biased. They believe it's not true, or there's something else that's causing it. The link has been proven, and they need to accept it.
Tyler, who went through the nutcracker drill, who played football with his brother, and watched the changes in him later take hold, agrees with his mom.
I definitely wouldn't be letting my kids play tackle football. Maybe in high school. Really, I haven't thought about that. I've always kind of felt that after my brother died, it was a blessing for me to have three girls, so I didn't have to. More than not, make that choice. You can learn too many of the basics of football, playing flag football. There really isn't any point in it. There's so many NFL and college players that didn't even play in junior high. Some of them barely played in high school. There's no point. You can learn the basic fundamentals of football without playing tackle.
And what about the good parts of football? Molding boys into men, teaching teamwork and toughness, and other great intangible qualities?
Of course, they tell you how that builds character. You should have seen my son's character the last 4 or 5 years of his life. That wasn't the Joseph that we knew.
There are lessons to be learned from the story of Joseph Chernek, the story of Tyler Helinski, the story of Junior Seau, and the stories of far too many other football players. Debbie Pica has made it her mission to make sure everybody hears them, everybody knows about the risks, and everybody knows how serious this issue is.
She basically quit her job to focus on bringing awareness. I know she's talked to families after loved ones have died and called them or had someone call them. I did that one time a few months ago and didn't get a very good response back, and for her to, and her friends, and keep doing that, it's not an easy thing to do, you know. I couldn't imagine doing that all the time. She went all in for sure, and I have a lot of respect for that.
Thank you for listening to the Raised Sports Podcast. To learn more about brain donation, search Child Athlete Advocates on Facebook or go to facesofcte.com. You can also call 800-891-1342 for more information. This episode was written and produced by me, Bob Harkins. The music is from Kai Engel, Chris Zabriski, and Sergei Cheremisinov. The theme song is from DL Sounds. Don't forget to check out our Patreon page, patreon.com/raisedsports. For as little as $1 a month, you can support this podcast and receive special member benefits. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.